Support for WAER Original Podcasts comes from California Closets of Syracuse, located in DeWitt. California Closets can help you get your entire home organized with custom-designed storage solutions for the home office, kitchen pantry, closets, and more. Online at californiaclosets.com.
Popular culture has long been divided along binary lines of gender. These divisions start from a very young age, so that a boy gets blue and a girl gets pink. One gets a doll, the other an action figure. One watches superheroes, the other princesses. Critics have long pointed out that popular culture tells us who we are supposed to be and how we are supposed to act from the time we reach the crib. But while these popular images of gender and sexuality may serve to limit and restrict our sense of ourselves, they may also serve as resources for us to imagine new ways of being who we want to be. I'm Kendall Phillips, and on this episode of Pop Life, we'll be exploring the complex intersection of popular culture, politics, gender, and sexuality with Dr. Ramsey Fawaz, a professor in the Department of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Fawaz is the author of The New Mutants, Superheroes and the Radical Imagination of American Comics, and a new book entitled Queer Forms, coming out in August from NYU Press. Ramsey, welcome to Pop Life.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here and chat with you about popular culture and gender and sexuality, my favorite things.
No, thrilled to have you, and I really enjoyed your new book and getting a chance to look at some of your thinking. And so I wonder if we could just start with the kind of the broad intersection that I was talking about in the open about the way pop culture kind of restricts but also enables our sense of gender and sexuality. How do you see all that functioning?
You know, I think the story that we usually tell is actually about the first side of the thing you just said. We usually tell a story about restriction, that part of what popular culture does is it sells us all of these ideas about, you know, normative, hegemonic, idealized gender and sexuality. We think of Leave It to Beaver, right? We think of all of the ways in which popular culture tells us this is the right way of doing gender and sexuality. And of course, that is part of what popular culture does, right? It circulates images to us of notions of the American good life, of the way things are quote unquote supposed to be. But, you know, my work is really interested in the flip side of that. I am really fascinated about popular culture's ability to proliferate imaginative versions of gender and sexuality that surprise audiences by giving them new terms for self-understanding. So a lot of what I do in my work is I study popular culture not as a transmitter of ideologies about gender and sexuality, but as a kind of ungrounded or open space of experimentation and play. So for instance, I'm very inspired in that thinking by a foundational book in this field, Susan Douglas's Where the Girls Are, this amazing book about growing up female in the 1950s with the mass media. And she basically says, look, if all of the 1950s popular culture forms, television, sitcoms, you know, movies, Hollywood musicals, et cetera, were selling us on this conservative idea about women being domestic goddesses, needing to stay in the home, how was it that the girls who grew up on that media became the leaders of women's liberation in the late 60s, right? And she says, actually, a lot of those things that we tend to think of as really conservative, I Dream of Jeannie, Leave It to Beaver, Bewitched, they were selling young women very ambivalent images, at once telling them women are supposed to be at home, and then also saying, well, you might also be a witch with superpowers and you can transform the world. And so I'm really interested in leveraging the potential of popular culture to imagine other ways of being gendered, other ways of having a sexuality that don't at all fit our prescribed norms. And that's what gives people like the capacity to project their own identity into new places, to become something else.
So I'm wondering, I'm thinking while you're saying that, I'm thinking about like, you know, traditional, the old school cultural studies. So I'm thinking of like Stuart Hall and that idea of oppositional decoding. But it seems like that is part of what is also a kind of ambivalence within the pop culture. So how much of this is people sort of intentionally, oppositionally misreading popular culture forms, and how much of it is the ambivalence built into those pop culture forms?
I mean, I think it completely depends on the object that you're looking at, right? So the Stuart Hall method that you're describing, I was so deeply influenced by that. I think he is a genius. But that model of the Birmingham School of Cultural Studies always presumed we study popular culture because it tells us something about the deep contradictions at the heart of a given culture, right? He kind of famously says at the end of that essay, Notes on Deconstructing the Popular, he says, you know, popular culture tells you about the culture's own internal war with itself about class hierarchy. And he famously says, and if it doesn't do that, then I don't give a damn about it. And I remember when I was a when I was an undergraduate, I found that so inspiring. And I was just like, yes, absolutely. But as I grew older, I thought, actually, I do give a damn about popular culture, even if it's not telling me, right, about class warfare or class hierarchy. I'm really interested in the other things that it does rather than just tell me about the internal contradictions of a culture. So I think absolutely there's no way that you can look at a piece of popular culture and not see some of the contradictions, the struggles of a society. So like one thing we'll talk about today, look at popular media today, and if you look at RuPaul's Drag Race and We're Here and other kind of gender performance shows, you would imagine that gender is completely unraveling and that like masculinity and femininity have been imploded. But you go and you watch Promising Young Woman and you watch HBO's Euphoria and you would think the opposite, right? That people are actually bifurcating in like aggressive terms towards hypermasculinity and hyperfemininity in a kind of intractable war of the genders. So of course, like popular culture carries within it the contradictions and the ambivalences of the culture, but it doesn't only do that, right? It's also a space of fantasy. It's also about a space of projecting what could be. And I think the only way you could know what level popular culture is doing either of those things is you'd have to take each object and study all of its different variables. You would have to look at, let's say, a text like Lovecraft Country and say, you know, what are the stories that it's telling in the text? Who created it? What were the stories they wanted to share with the world? How do audiences receive it? You'd have to look at it from so many different angles. So I'm really never one to predetermine or decide in advance what I think a cultural text is doing or saying. I kind of allow it to tell me a story that I can run with, if that makes sense.
No, it totally does, because I think you're right. There is maybe at least the assumption that most of critics doing work like you're doing out of that kind of school of critical thought or cultural studies are always looking at pop culture as this restrictive binding, and we either accept it or we oppose it. But you're really finding in that cultural form a space for this kind of radical imagination where you take those resources, that kind of equipment that pop culture gives us, and we remake it into something that feels more like how we want to be in the world.
I 100%, right? And again, I want to stress, you know, I was trained in that way of reading popular culture as a repository or an archive of ideological messages. And I think there's no way that mass media, which is created out of these huge corporate conglomerates, right, funded by mass global capital, there's no way that they are not ideological. There's no way that you watch, you know, the Black Panther, and no matter how radical and liberatory and an amazing feat for Black representation, that movie is also deeply conservative in a lot of ways, right? It's about the alliance of a Black monarchy with the CIA in order to put down a radical Black rebellion against that regime. And yet that movie does so much more than its ideological content would suggest. It is really an extraordinary representational fantasy for a Black superpower. And so, as I've kind of gotten older as a scholar, I think admittedly, I've become a little bit bored of the ideological critique, because it always seems the most obvious to me that all of us are now weirdly very well versed in at least all of us right on the left or the progressive left seem very well versed at being able to identify all the ways that culture fails us. And as a result of that, we have lost sight of the fact that cultural production is also a massive resource with which we can sell a completely new imagination about the way the world could be. And you know, I always go back to Eve Sedgwick's kind of famous joke where she says, you know, where we end up with all of the ideological critique is ultimately just looking at every piece of popular culture and saying it's a little bit conservative, a little bit liberatory. Right? Like that's what we end up saying about everything, right? Bewitched is like a little bit liberatory because it shows women with power, and it's a little bit conservative because it's all about domesticity. And my thing is like, well, what else is culture doing? Right? Like, what else is it trying to help us imagine? And so for me, my view of popular culture today is I think about it the way a political theorist might think about it, which is that to me, popular culture at its best is a meditation on intractable political problems in the society that it is trying to work through imaginatively. Like, how do we figure our way around X or Y problem, right? So for instance, I'm really interested in cultural texts that say, if one of the fundamental problems of the left today is that we can only articulate our experience of marginalization as one of woundedness, right? Mm. Like the wounds of homophobia, racism, sexism, what does it look like to honor those injuries, but also tell a story that is not about trauma? That is not about woundedness. Like, I'm fascinated by popular culture that tries to do that. Like, what? How do I answer X question? And I think gender and sexuality are realms of invention, right? Like, these are things that we're always inventing. What are our desires? How do I want to express my gender? And I think only reading them ideologically is painful, actually. It's not very useful for figuring out what kind of gendered life you want to live in. So I'm more and more moved away from the ideological critique just to open up or leverage something else.
Yeah, so it is kind of breaking up that binary of, you know, that it's all about, you know, either one side or the other. And it's not just about circulating trauma and ideology. It's also about circulating joy and imagination. So I'm wondering,
exactly,
are there periods of time where that imaginative ground is more fertile, or you see more kind of dynamic interaction with the culture and more of that kind of imaginative moment?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the 70s, of course, is a prime example. So is the 1930s. I think like the most fertile times for that kind of transformative potential is when explosive, radical social movements begin to capture the hearts and minds and the imagination of the mass public. And I was talking with one of my colleagues yesterday about the fact that there's a really fascinating way in which the civil rights movement and Black power in the 60s and 70s, along with women's and gay liberation, more than almost any other movements of that time, captured the public imagination so that suddenly you were seeing new images of gender and sexual dissidents and racial dissidents in movies, in television shows, in popular comics, right? Which is what I write so much about in The New Mutants. And I think what's fascinating is that millions of Americans in that period would never have claimed that they were radical feminists, that they were gay liberationists, but they were deeply inspired by some of the ideas of those movements, the ideas of coming out of the closet, of consciousness raising, right, of collective protest. People were looking at that on TV and saying, wow, like I might not be one of those activists, but maybe this, like I could borrow like 10% of that gay liberationist way of being in my own life. And I think that began to translate into popular culture. Both because, of course, corporations knew that they would sell well to audiences that were kind of lit up by these rebellious practices, but also because artists, writers, and filmmakers were deeply inspired by the fantasy or the ideal of a different kind of world that was more open to gender and sexual and racial variety and diversity. So I think those historical moments when social movements are deeply aligned with cultural revolution is when we see that in this country. There's a reason why the 1930s came to be understood by scholars like Michael Denning as the cultural front. This moment when all of the different factions of the left joined together with the more moderate New Deal left to reinvent everything about American culture, from theater to music to movies to radio, to imagine a kind of a global internationalism, a cosmopolitan solidarity before World War II. And so those are moments that I'm particularly interested in as a scholar, which isn't to say that more conservative moments don't also produce incredible things, right? The 1980s, one could argue, is one of the most conservative political and cultural eras in the US. But the cultures of AIDS activism produced theater like Angels in America, countless movies and video documentary that was also very radical. So I'm interested in kind of mapping those moments in my work when social movement politics somehow trickle into cultural, everyday cultural production to transform people's imaginative horizon.
In your new book, Queer Forms, which is going to be coming out soon through NYU Press, and I know all our listeners will want to go out and get a copy, you've decided to focus on the 1970s. And so clearly mm-hmm. that was the kind of time you're talking about. A lot of cultural yes. politics, a lot of turmoil, that post-1968 kind of echoing through mm-hmm. the culture. And you pick some very interesting examples to kind of unpack that dynamic imagination. Yeah. So I wonder if you could talk about, like for example, you have a chapter that talks about the Stepford Wives, which yeah. seems a kind of improbable narrative in some ways for you to yes. pick up. So could you unpack a little bit of that to give us a flavor of how this analysis works?
Absolutely. And I'll say, you know, in a nutshell, what the book does, what Queer Forms does, is it takes like five or six of the key concepts that emerged out of the movements for women's and gay liberation. So the idea, for instance, of women's equality, the idea of coming out of the closet about one's sexuality, the idea of consciousness raising, of women and queer people sitting together in a circle and sharing their experiences of sexism and homophobia. These were really important feminist and queer political strategies that were translated into cultural forms before, so that mass audiences could literally see them. Mm. So for example, I do a chapter on The Boys in the Band, a widely despised gay Hollywood film right. about a group of gay male friends who sit in a circle debating their experiences of homophobia. And I argued that it modeled the experience of feminist consciousness raising for mass audiences. It literalized the experience of people sitting in a circle, vehemently dialoguing about these experiences. And I do that in every chapter. I say, like, here's a concept, here's how it gets translated into an aesthetic or creative form. And one of the things that drives me is to look at popular culture that has been, to my mind, misread as negative, conservative, or even like liberal middle of the road and kind of thrown by the wayside, and to revitalize its power to say, actually, it's doing some really, really interesting work that is surprising. So to take the Stepford Wives, right, here's a novella by Ira Levin, who's a brilliant horror story writer, that is all about the terror of suburban conformity. These white women move to this town thinking that they're gonna start a new life, and they begin to see all of the women that they thought of as vibrant and alive becoming robotic and mechanical. And in the movie version that most people know, it is revealed that in fact the women are being killed and replaced by robots. And the novella has kind of gone by the wayside. People look at it and say, oh, it was entertaining, but it's kind of just like white liberal pandering. there's a few references to Betty Friedan. It's kind of like simple-minded is the view. But what I argue is actually, it's an amazing meditation on the problem of dealing with women's differences. Like, the real issue at the core of the novella is not that the women are turned into robots. It is that they are actually way more desiring of the suburban conformity they claim to hate than they would like to admit. And so the book is actually an internal critique of homogenous thinking of among purported progressive feminists or everyday feminists. And it pushes feminisms of all varieties to self-critique, to be thoughtful about their own desire for normativity, for even some sexist things in our society that we don't even realize that we want, right? So it's a critique of kind of feminism's cruel optimism, for domesticity. And that to me is so interesting and complex, and it's packaged in a totally thrilling and scary story in which ultimately no robots appear, right? So in the original novella, there are no robots. They are a fantasy that the women project to try to explain away their own conformity to this suburban neighborhood that they keep saying that they hate. So that's one example. And another that I'm really proud of is that I do a very long reading of Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City, which was the most popular gay serial fiction of the 1970s. It appeared over 2 years in the San Francisco Chronicle and was read by millions of straight and gay Americans. And it told the story of this group of queer friends living on Russian Hill. And one of the things I claim in that chapter is that coming out of the closet, was an experience basically not only of articulating your sexuality, like I'm gay or I'm trans, right? Or your gender expression. It was also something you had to perform over time, like over and over and over again. You never came out once, you came out over and over and over again. And the suggestion of gay liberationists was that coming out is so powerful because it's a process. It's not simply an admission of a kind of truth about the self, but something that you do and repeat in a repeated process over time that other people watch you evolve into and then might be inspired by to come out. So what I argue is that that experience of immediately or punctually admitting something about yourself, I'm gay, then unfolds over time. And that's literally what serial narrative looks like, right? Every daily installment of Tales of the City looks like a declaration of sexuality or gender expression. But the stories that unfold over time show you the evolution of these characters as they become more queer, more feminist, right? More versions of themselves that are gender and sexual nonconforming. And so I argue that the serial unfolding of Tales of the City, formally modeled in creative or aesthetic form, the shape of the experience of coming out of the closet, transmitting that experience to audiences who may never have thought of themselves as people that would ever come out. So those are kind of two examples. I'm happy to elaborate on more.
Now, I think those are really helpful examples. And I guess I'm wondering if you see similar processes going on. And I guess I'm thinking of even slightly more mainstream. So I'm thinking like network television. So I'm thinking of the 1970s and I guess particularly like strong female characters like Maude or even Mary Tyler Moore, or Angie Dickinson in Police Woman, and as well as the introduction of increasingly openly gay characters. I can remember Billy Crystal in the long-running, also serial television show Soap. And I'm wondering if that is a way that those kind of core narratives, whether Stepford Wives or Boys in the Band or Tales of the City, get further circulated into a kind of even more mainstream culture.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I actually think that the field of media studies has done an extraordinary job of studying 1970s television, like feminist television, in some ways, television studies, which is really a feminist endeavor from its beginning, starts with these analyses of shows like Maude, right? And the Mary Tyler Moore Show. I mean, for me, a touchstone in relation to that is, like Paul Mazursky's movie, which I talk about very briefly in my introduction to my book, An Unmarried Woman, which comes out in like 1978-79, which begins this tradition of having mainstream Hollywood films that are about primary woman characters who are professionals, who are just kind of doing their things, like, right? Like another version of this will be 9 to 5 within just a couple of years. And I think what's interesting about An Unmarried Woman is precisely how it speaks both to a very mainstream audience. It has a totally lovable and endearing main character in the brilliant actress Jill Klaber. It does not, you know, it doesn't really ruffle the feathers of people around race. It's very much a white narrative. And yet at the same time, it is a story about a woman who is left by her husband totally unexpectedly, and then reconstitutes her life and decides that she doesn't ever want to get married again. And even when she meets this amazing artist and they fall in love, he's very invested in them getting married. And she's like, no, I'll stick with you as long as you just like stop pressuring me. And the beauty at the end of the movie is that she continues on with her life and he stays part of it, but she lives it the way she wants. And that kind of is the beginning of that possibility, right? Of like the woman's Bildungsroman, like the story in mainstream media that there are narratives to be told about women that are primarily about their needs and their wants. And so I absolutely think that there is a major impact of these more independent, avant-garde, or difficult works or niche works into a broader mainstream.
One of the things I like about your discussion of an unmarried woman, and I think it brings us to, in some ways, a point you make in the conclusion of the book, is that it does ask us to rethink our relationships with others. And in the conclusion, yeah. I thought a really powerful moment in your book is you turn to this concept of friendship as a kind yeah. of different way of imagining relations. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how yeah. these texts that you're analyzing lead us to ask that question about what friendship means and how it relates and how it's formed
Absolutely.
By pop culture.
So, you know, I mean, something that a theme that runs through my book is contemporary queer, feminist, and transgender social justice discourse. So even though I talk primarily about the 1970s, the book is always telescoping outward from the radical gender and sexual freedom projects of the 70s to the current moment, right? There's no question we're having a major gender and sexual revolution in this country. Transgender has become part of central to the debate about gender and sexual freedom and expression. And yet in many ways, contemporary social justice movements have abandoned the feminist and queer 1970s. Mm. There's a perception of that period as racist, transphobic, backward, lacking in what we now would call intersectional analysis. And a lot of my book is saying like, no, actually, so many of our best ideas come from that moment. And one of the most powerful things that emerged out of the 1970s was the idea that the friendship between queer people and women, the friendship between gender and sexual dissidents, is the one social relationship that survives the rise and fall of social movements, right? Like social movements emerge just like Black Lives Matter, just like contemporary transgender revolution, just like climate justice. These movements emerge in relationship to specific historical moments and the problems unique to those moments. And as generations pass and the world changes, social movements evolve. Sometimes they collapse. Sometimes they, right, like they mutate into something else. And the one thing that survives those mutations and transformations are the everyday, ordinary, quotidian friendships that are forged between people who never expected that they would feel affinity and connection. And one of the great revelations of that, right, is that a lot of people are brought to those movements because they think they're going to find community with people just like them, right? Like, I'm going to join Black Lives Matter because then everybody there will be just like me. And what you discover when you get there is that you don't like some of those people, or some of the people you never thought you would be friends with are actually amazing companions. So friendship is kind of chaotic and wild in the same way that gender and sexuality is, especially the way we've been arguing that these are socially constructed categories that are open to reinvention. So at the end of the book, I sit with why it is that contemporary social justice discourse often places so much stress on the need for social movements to provide for all of or minister to the needs of individual people, that it actually makes it impossible for us to really value concrete queer and feminist friendship. Because what we're really enamored of is the idea that what friendship should do is heal the social wounds of racism, homophobia, transphobia, and sexism. And part of what I say is it can't. Right? Those things are so vast and complex. What friendships do is they allow us to see ourselves in new ways, from new dimensions. And by extension, I make the kind of unusual argument that maybe we could actually see feminist and queer popular culture the way we would see a friend, as imperfect, as flawed as offering us new versions of ourselves to play with and then sometimes let go of, right? To expect that popular culture should function the way a social movement does, to try and minister to the harms of an unjust society seems to be to kind of take, it's to take for granted what its role is, which is to expand our imagination. And I think that's what friendship is. It's a scene of mutually shared imagination. And I kind of encourage people to cultivate the value of friendship in our current social movements against kind of a recriminatory, wounded politics that we see in things like canceling.
Do you think fandom or fan culture is a kind of example of this friendship where we, you know, find love in a piece of pop culture, even if it's flawed, and also find relations with others, even though they may be different from us?
I think it absolutely can be. It just depends on how you do it, right? We've seen the best and the worst of fan cultures in the current moment. In the wake of all of these social justice debates about representational diversity, we've seen the huge efflorescence of really amazing forms, for instance, of cosplay, in which so many marginalized people across race, gender, sexuality, ability, dress up as their favorite characters from different imaginative universes, find that they like have a place to belong. And we've also seen fan communities freak out when right. gay characters and Black characters are introduced, claiming proprietary ownership over superhero universes. So fandom is not in any way exempt from the possibilities of deep conservatism, right? And in fact, it is the assumption that a fan community is supposed to provide a universal home for one's identity that leads some fans to say, oh, well, as soon as you start introducing gay characters, I don't feel like I belong because it's really supposed to be about me. And so I think fan communities can be an incredibly rich site for creating friendship if the way that people approach the community is open and creative and about the unexpected affinities and connections that can be built with people unlike you, rather than being built around rules of conduct. So one thing I talk a lot about at the end of the book is that everybody on the right and the left today seems obsessed with rule following. People want a set of guidelines about like, what will true community look like? And the problem with that is that actual community is always being produced in the moment in surprising and unpredictable ways. So you think about the fact that on the left, we're very invested in telling each other what is good representation, what is ideological and what isn't. This is the right way you talk about pronouns. This is the wrong way to talk about sexuality. We're so enamored of trying to create a set of guidelines. This is what's good, this is what's bad, that we forget that we're supposed to be debating those things. We're supposed to be figuring out together in the manner of friendship, like, what is it that we want for ourselves? What does a world where we're mutually flourishing look like, rather than a moralizing commandment to be one way or another? And I think that fan communities can be either. Fan communities can be incredibly creative, open-ended spaces for invention, or they can be about moralizing, about this is the way the representation should look. And why didn't you do it that way, right? We also, all of us know stories in the indie comics world of fans publicly canceling or attacking creators who they feel haven't adequately represented one identity or another the way they would like them to, which shuts down the ability to debate the question of like, well, what is the representation that you want, right? And what would that look like? And could you invent it? So it's a long answer to your question. I think it all depends on how you want to shape the values of that fan community.
Well, Queer Forms, the new book from Ramzi Fawaz, is a fascinating meditation on exactly these kinds of relationships and affinities and our love for pop culture. And speaking of which, as regular listeners of Pop Life will know, in addition to having wonderful conversations with our amazing new friends about aspects of their expertise, we also love to dig into their love of pop culture. And we usually begin that segment, Ramzi, with a little game we call the Fast Five. So I'm going to ask you five questions about pop culture and ask you to follow your heart and pick one out of these options. So we'll start with question number one. Since you write about androids and replicants in your new book, Which of these robotic companions would you rather have with you on a cross-country road trip? Would it be Rosie from the cartoon series The Jetsons or Wally from the Pixar film of the same name? So is it Rosie or Wally?
Rosie.
I feel like you get a better conversation. I think Wally just says Wally, so that's not yeah. a particularly way to spend
Wally's miles already in love. Rosie's ready to break out of that family.
I think I'm with you. I think Rosie's got some potential. Question number two for you. Which would you rather do? Would you like to have high tea with Catherine the Great from the series The Great on Hulu or play a game of chess with Beth Harmon from the Netflix series The Queen's Gambit?
Oh, Catherine the Great. Oh, I love that show.
And I think, for me at least, the Beth Harmon game would last two moves and I would have to shuffle along.
Yeah, that's fair.
Question number three for you, Ramsey. Since we've been talking about pop culture in the 1970s, I have to ask at least one music question, and it's this. Mm-hmm. Which is the more iconic song from that era? Is it the Bee Gees' Staying Alive or the Village People's YMCA?
Staying Alive.
I think that's a great choice. Who can turn away from Saturday Night Fever? Question number four, sticking with the 1970s for a second. Where would you rather spend your next vacation? In The Vortex, the deceptively idyllic pastoral land from John Borman's 1974 film Zardoz, or at Westworld, the robotic amusement park from Michael Crichton's 1973 film Westworld?
Oh, The Vortex, for sure.
Much less likely to get shot, I think, in The Vortex than in Westworld.
I mean, I'll get lost in a hive mind for a while. I know how to get myself out of it.
I think I've been there.
I don't know how to escape Westworld. I would definitely die.
So finally, Ramsey, question number five, last of our Fast Five questions. I can't resist asking at least one superhero question. So if you were heading off to battle with some nefarious supervillain, which new mutant would you want at your side? Sunspot, whose superhuman strength is fueled by the sun, or Wolfsbane, who can transform into a werewolf?
Oh, can I break out of that question? Because to me, it would have to be Mirage. It would have to be Danny Moonstar.
You are the guest, so you're absolutely entitled. I think Mirage is an excellent choice.
Always. I love every member of that team. They are all in my heart, but it's always about Danny.
Pop life is a tough life. We always have to make hard choices, and you've done an excellent job here. So finally, Ramsey, what are you loving at the moment? What are you listening? What are you binging? What are you watching?
What am I watching? I just saw Everything Everywhere All at Once. It's one of the most amazing things I have ever witnessed in my life. I'm definitely writing about it in my next book. I cannot recommend it enough. I binge watched HBO Station 11, which blew my mind. I had enjoyed the book, but I wasn't completely transformed by it. The television adaptation is such an incredible meditation on trauma. About like the trauma of watching our world collapse. It's so idiosyncratic. It's so weird. It feels very avant-garde. I found it beautiful. And similarly, Gilded Age on HBO just felt like candy. An amazing feast. And you know, this is going to be kind of random. One of the best things that I discovered during COVID, the first part of COVID, was all of the podcasts of Esther Perel, who is a world famous psychotherapist who works with couples. I think she's a genius. I mean, I think she's really a model of what a public intellectual is like. You think that you're just gonna listen to some couples doing therapy with her and it's no big deal. You leave feeling like you understand life and relationships and the universe in such an expansive way. I think she is just so, so brilliant. And, you know, one last thing I'll say, because I could go on forever. I watch so many things. You know, I read this a few years ago. I write about it. I still, to this day, think that Jeff Vandermeer's The Southern Reach Trilogy is, which the first book is called Annihilation, and it was made into a movie. And the movie doesn't hold a candle to the books. Mm. It's one of the most moving, powerful, brilliant speculative fictions I've ever read in my life. It brings me to tears. Like, I think I pursue popular culture today that moves me. And I'm so moved by this book. It is an amazing science fiction adventure ride, terrifying, beautiful, enchanting. And you'll read the entire trilogy like in two sittings because you can't get enough. So I can't recommend that enough.
some excellent choices. And I would say to our listeners, of course, the book that recently moved me was this amazing new book, Queer Forms, coming out soon
thank
from
you.
NYU Press. Ramsey, thank you so much for joining us. And to our listeners, I'll remind you, whatever form your pop culture takes, odds are we'll be talking about it here on Pop Life. I will see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Pop Life, a production of WAER Syracuse Public Media. You can find archived episodes at WAER.org. And don't forget to subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen for automatic delivery of new episodes.